Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 180, being recorded on the 24th of May, 2017, with special guests Felipe Ayora and Martin DeVries. I'm Sujit Mello, and on Skype with me, I have, of course, Kale, Evan, Anas, and our special guests. And it's a special show. Our guests are actually from two different continents. We'll get to that in a minute. It took a little bit of a feat to get everybody on the phone at this particular time. So really appreciate them joining us. I know it's early or late for some of them, and we'll get to them in just a minute. But before that, let's just start with our usual round of updates. And, the last show we did, was a little late, so we did it just a few days ago. And just in 3 or 4 days since we did the last show,
got a whole bunch.
There's so many updates. It just blows my mind. You know,
I think Kale's cheating though, right? Because 3 out of our are all blocked. 3 out of the 10 or 12 are blockchain. So I think
it's blockchain week this week. That's why.
Yeah. And you know, talking about blockchain, I don't know if you guys looked at our Twitter feed. We had some people that said, you know, when we missed the show or we were late in publishing it, they're like, oh, I'm missing my blockchain update. I'm like, oh, my God.
Nice. We've created a monster.
Anyways, speaking of blockchain, why don't you, Kale, do you want to give us a quick update? You've got 2 or 3 items in there, as Evan mentioned.
Yeah, there's a couple in the blog post this week, primarily because this week was a pretty large, one of the biggest blockchain conferences in the world. It happens here in New York every year, and it happened this week here. We just finished it up. It's called Consensus, is the name of the conference. It's at the Marriott here in Times Square. And we had about 3,000 people there from all walks of life. I mean, a lot of developers, technical companies, banks, the SEC was there, you know, governments, these kind of things, talking about this. But so from a Microsoft standpoint, a couple things that we're working on. One of them, we introduced a new framework to allow people to build POCs. We call it a POC framework that allows it to basically use metadata and glean some information from things like smart contracts that exist on a blockchain and be able to scaffold out an application in Angular without writing any code. So it makes it easy for people. You can read the blog post, but it's, you know, these things are quite extensive. You can get into 10 or 12 weeks doing a POC, and, you know, that can be quite costly for an enterprise. So we're looking for ways to kind of lower the bar there, make it easier for people to start actually building what they actually want, which is an application that runs on top of these things.
That's cool. Now, how does that, now you said it can glean the information from the smart contracts. So do smart contracts have this concept like a WSDL or something, you know, like we used to have in the SOAP days?
If you take Ethereum, for instance, they have, when you compile a smart contract, it's essentially like JavaScript code. Mm-hmm. And when you compile it, it compiles to binary, but it also outputs a file called an ABI file, which is like an interface file. So yeah, it's very similar to
the metadata
stuff you're used to. Yeah.
Okay, got it. Cool.
The other piece we did was something I was working a lot on the last month, a bunch of new protocols for blockchain in Azure. So we have 5 main protocols out there. One of the big ones being Hyperledger Fabric is one that we now support in Azure. It's out there right now. R3 Corda, Quorum Chain, and BlockApps. We basically... Now, up to this point, we had like basically single nodes out there to allow developers to kind of use it and see how the consensus algorithm works and play with it. These are full fan out. So multi-node templates, you can do scale up, make these things run much faster. You can scale individual pieces of them. And they're all different technologies. So it's been pulling my hair out for the last month, making sure all these things work. So the ones that are out there in full-scale form right now are Hyperledger, R3, and BlockApps, and the other two are coming by the end of the week here, Quorum and Chain.
I hate to admit it, Sujit, but I think we're going to have to block out no pun intended, unfortunately. Another show for Kale to talk about blockchain.
I know, I know. Yeah,
definitely, man.
Look at these updates; it's just crazy. Yeah, no, that's good. So does that kind of round up all the stuff that you wanted to talk about?
Yep, that's good.
That's great, thanks, Evan. How about you? What do you have?
So I'm going to go back to one of my kind of common themes over time, which is, you know, we're adding this new cloud shell, right, that we announced last week at Build, where you can run CLI in a kind of a containerized instance. And now we've got a private preview for PowerShell. But really, to me, what this really goes back to is some of the stuff we talked about early on in the podcast, which is these days, it is not only is it not unusual for us to have a CL, you know, a kind of quote-unquote Microsoft stack variant, right, the PowerShell, and a non-Microsoft stack one. But on top of that, now it's actually becoming more and more common that you see it come out in the non-traditional Microsoft stack first.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and this is just a, you know, again, PowerShell's out, which is awesome, but reminder, CLI came out last week and was GA. I'm sorry, public preview, but PowerShell's still in private preview.
Right.
So.
That's cool. That's a good sign, I think.
Yeah.
And let's see, so they've got a bunch of other kind of smaller updates. I think on the IaaS side, they've got some price reductions in these general purpose VMs.
Yeah.
The D series version 2 or DV2 as they're called. And actually, I've been using them. Those are good prices because they have SSDs. And so I've been using a lot of them recently, and they're very, very cost effective. And they've dropped the prices. They've been more like, you know, 5 to 7% drop, but still very reasonably priced. But also on the IaaS theme, so, you know, we have this managed disks now, and to be able the thing is, managed disks are priced by the size of the disk, obviously. And so the traditional Windows Server IaaS image that was out there in the gallery was pretty large. So right off the bat, you know, you're paying for a lot of
that's
managed
right,
disks.
That's right, because you're paying for what you allocate, not what you use. It's
exactly.
Not sparse anymore like it used to be.
So now they've come up with these very smaller Windows Server IaaS images for just to get better value out of the managed disk, so that you're not paying for a whole lot. So
I'm gonna date myself, but that's what we started with, and then we went to these bigger ones because we were only charging for what you used, and it kept being a problem because you can't expand them. So that's kind of funny. What's old is new again.
Yep. So that's out there. And then also in the IoT space, which is one of my kind of areas of interest, you know, there's always been this concept of the gateway, which is, you know, you may have a building of hundreds of IoT devices, and you don't want all of those devices to talk to the Azure cloud directly. They go through a gateway. But there's never been any good tutorial on how to set up that gateway, you know, to work with IoT Suite. And so now they've added a new tutorial for that, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. What else? Anything else you guys want to pick up here?
The NVIDIA stuff I thought was
that
pretty
is good.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right. You know, trying to do, you know, kind of the high-end graphics stuff on these hosted VMs is, you know, using the NVIDIA grid or enabling the NVIDIA grid kind of high performance computing, you know, coincidentally, like what we're talking about later on today. But, you know,
and
that's leveraging those GPUs.
And it's really interesting because the device is actually sitting on premises, right? The workstation that you're doing the drawing or the CAD software or whatever, but the processing is happening remotely, you know, in the cloud. And so
it's kind of a neat way of, it's sort of like we do Xbox games, right? There's some local stuff, but then a lot of the hardcore processing is offline.
True. That is true. Yeah. Okay, and then, for, you know, I mean, I'm an app developer, and one of the issues we face all the time when using SQL Server Database, right, is, okay, you can use SQL Server Database to create a quick application, but what happens if you want to create a SaaS application, right, a software as a service application? That requires special setup for SQL Server because you really want to make a multi-tenanted version of SQL Server, right? You want to take your SQL Server and you want to say, you know, tenant A gets this part of the SQL Server, and tenant B gets that part, and tenant A should never see what's in tenant B, right? So there's all these tricky things that happen when you try to build a SaaS application using SQL database. And so there's a nice kind of a set of patterns that they've created to help you identify all these topics when you're building a SaaS application using SQL database. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. All right, I think, is there anything else you guys want to pick? I think that kind of rounds up everything, right, here for
Yeah,
the most part.
it's good.
Okay, let's get, without further ado, why don't we turn over to our special guests? So I'll let Felipe, if you can start with introducing yourself, and then we'll move to Martin.
Perfect. Hi, guys. So, hey, my name is Felipe Ayora. I'm part of the HPC team now in Azure. We're basically the HPC team in Microsoft. We work on a combination of infrastructure technologies like the InfiniBand capable VMs, H series, and previous to that, the A8 and A9. My team also owns the GPUs that you guys were talking about. Yeah, they're part of the kind of the big compute HPC scope that we try to cover. And we also offer a few solutions and services like Azure Batch, which is basically HPC as a service. So that's pretty much it. And like you were saying, I'm pretty much at the other side of the world, I would say, from at least from Martijn. I'm in New Zealand. Yeah, our team acquired a small Kiwi startup. You know, they call New Zealanders Kiwis. And a couple of us from Redmond came to be with the team here during the transition. So that's why I'm in New Zealand.
Ah, okay, that explains it. Okay, great. Well, and thanks for joining from so far away. We'll
Pleasure.
then let's just quick, Martijn, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. So my name is Martijn de Vries. I'm the CTO at Bright Computing, based out of Amsterdam, the Netherlands. And the company I work for is Bright Computing. So we build cluster management software. So we've been in the HPC business for about 13 years, building software that allows administrators to turn a pile of hardware into a fully functional cluster. So we started out with HPC. That's still the majority of our customer base, but in recent years, we've also branched out into OpenStack, Kubernetes, Mesos, machine learning, and also big data clusters running Hadoop and Spark.
Wow. Every time I hear about this kind of clustering of machines, I think about SETI. Do you guys remember
Yeah.
Yeah.
Used to run the screensaver back
Yeah,
in the
that
day.
was the ultimate cluster, right? I
Yeah.
mean, it used everybody's machine to
Yep.
process applications.
Yeah, so these kind of distributed machines can only be used for a very specific set of parallel problems. So only ones that do not require a lot of communication and for which the computation can be chopped up into very large chunks. So that is pretty atypical, I would say.
Right. Now, so Martin, you deal on the on-premises kind of clustering or HPC, and Felipe, you're more in the cloud HPC. Is that fair to say?
It's
Yeah,
almost
originally we
correct. I'll let Martin explain.
Yeah, so we started out 13 years ago, obviously with on-premise, and we're still doing on-premise. But we see a lot of interest in from our user base in moving computations to the cloud. So we allow in the latest version of our software, we added support for Azure, and we allow our customers to spin up a completely virtualized HPC cluster inside of Azure. That's one model. The other model is in our opinion much more interesting, and that is allow people who have an on-premise Bright cluster to extend it into Azure. So this gives you the best of both worlds. So computations that need to be run on-premise can be run on-premise, and computations that do lend themselves to be moved to the cloud can very easily be offloaded to Azure.
Okay. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, though. We used to have a Windows Server SKU, right, that had something to do with HPC. Am I is that correct?
Yes,
Yeah, about
actually.
10 years ago.
Yeah,
What happened to
actually,
that?
we still. So the SKU came as in parallel, if you may, no pun intended, with HPC Pack. The solution actually is called Microsoft HPC Pack. It was basically a solution that was built on top of Windows Server to do something similar to what Bright Computing does. You know, it's a cluster manager, scheduling capabilities, deployment, monitoring, reporting, all the good stuff that you need in a in an HPC scheduler or grid scheduler, as they also tend to be called. The SKU was accompanying that solution because at the scale at which our customers needed to run, they needed a much more attractive price, if you may, because we're talking about hundreds and sometimes thousands of Windows Server machines, right? So the SKU was part of the kind of HPC package. And then we continue to work on HPC pack. Actually, we have a team in Shanghai that's been part of the HPC pack development team for many, many years. And they continue to work in that because we still have many, many customers using it. And most of them, I would say right now, are looking at something similar to what Bright has, which is the hybrid scenario or the burst scenario where they have an on-premises presence. They still take advantage of their on-premises infrastructure and use HPC pack or Bright Computing to scale that as needed onto the cloud. But I must say that the solution that Bright has in place is extremely, extremely good. It just makes it tremendously easy to do that bursting, staging the data and all the stuff. So I think Martijn is being a bit humble about it all, but it's an extremely good solution.
Let me ask you for one thing though. What's the most typical workload or scenario you use to explain a good usage of HPC or the clustering software, for example? What kind of application would you typically see running on this environment?
Anything that requires a very large computation. So typically,
give me a tangible example. You know, something that we could relate to.
Well, when a nuclear bomb needs to be tested, for example, somebody can either blow up an island somewhere in the Pacific or they can simulate the explosion. And obviously, there's benefits to simulating it rather than carrying it out for real.
That's a good
example. The other one that I tend to use is there's two types of jobs. The kind of job that can be basically run in what we call embarrassingly parallel mode, which is they don't need to talk to each other. You can have hundreds or thousands of computers. They basically scale enormously, where they don't need to talk to each other. The perfect example, I think, is movie rendering, right? If you grab a movie, you split it into, a few minutes or specific, the specific slices? Frames, yeah. And then you give each one of those to a computer to render separately. Then you just need to stitch them in the end. So let's say if each frame takes, 5 minutes to render, instead of having to go 5 minutes plus 5 minutes plus 5 minutes, if you were to do it serially on one computer, you would just take 5 minutes to render the whole movie and then put it together after a few minutes with some program that stitches it at the end. The other great example, and that's for the other types of jobs, the ones that require the specialized infrastructure that we have in Azure, is the type of job that we call tightly coupled. For that, you actually need the computers to constantly talk to each other and to do so as quickly as possible. So many people, when they talked about, let's say, the InfiniBand network that we have there, is one of the perhaps the most common solution for this tight interconnect. They think about throughput, but it's really the latency that matters, right? The 3 microseconds that, for example, we can achieve, because what happens is you can finish the calculation on each one of those separate computers in nanoseconds, and then the CPUs are basically twiddling their thumbs waiting for the communication to happen through the network to continue with their communication. And the best example for that is car crash simulation. Basically, you take, and you've probably seen those, you take a complex, geometry of a car and split it into triangles and polygons, whatever it is that you need to do. And then you simulate that crashing against the wall, let's say. And what happens is that first polygon at the very tip of the car is going to start basically changing its shape as it hits the wall. But that change of shape affects every other polygon around it, right? It's going to press against it. And that in turn is going to affect the next one and the next one and the next one. So in a problem like that, you need these very tightly coupled jobs to be connected through a very fast interconnect. So those are the two typical examples that I use to explain these.
So that I remember when I, so I have a chemical engineering background. When I first got into industry, I actually did a lot of computer simulations. And I remember having a $50,000, I think it was a Sun workstation, something like that, just to run these things because we could get them done in a day, right? And these were not complicated simulations compared to what we do these days that we do much faster, or we do more complicated in the same amount of time with this, with the distributed model you're talking about, right? That's exactly what you guys are enabling with this massive, large amount of parallelization, right? Is to either do a lot more complexity in the same amount of time, or a lot more complexity in the same amount of time, or the same amount of complexity in a much, much, much shorter time.
That's exactly it. The two things kind of go hand in hand, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly it. And I would like to talk a little bit more about actually Bright Computing, because what I like about Bright, to be honest, is that there's this idea of modeling behind HPC, but and I often get asked this question, you know, how about big data? Is big data HPC? Yes, certain problems of big data are solved with HPC as the underlying infrastructure. And solutions like Bright have made that tremendously easy, to be honest. It kind of expands the usage of HPC in really cool ways.
Okay. So what does Bright bring to the table then? How exactly does it make this easier? Is this the management of the nodes, or the management of the software, the way you deploy the software to the nodes, or all of the above? What does it do?
All of the above. So in general, we make things easy. So for example, we streamline the setup process of Hadoop and Spark and OpenStack and Kubernetes. So that the administrator does not have to reinvent the wheel in order to get their workload running. So after it's been deployed, we'd also take care of monitoring and health checking for example, OpenStack or Hadoop or Spark. And we also allow you to change the configuration, control the configuration of these what we call workload engines.
Now you mentioned Hadoop and Spark. So there's all Bright Bright Computing clusters involve Hadoop and Spark?
Oh, no, not at all. So I would say 80% of our customers are only running a traditional HPC workload. So they don't do any Hadoop or Spark or OpenStack, for example.
And in those cases, what role does the Bright Computing software play?
So we streamlined the whole deployment process for the cluster. So obviously you don't want to install a 5,000 node cluster with a DVD. So we deploy software images onto nodes. We make sure that everything stays healthy. So hardware is bound to break at large scale. So we monitor everything. We health check everything. We also provide a rich collection of HPC tools and libraries so that scientists can get up and running very quickly with their scientific workload. In the area of machine learning, we provide a full set of machine learning frameworks, CNTK being one of them. So we have various customers that are relying on Bright's machine learning tool stack in order to run their machine learning workloads.
So Martin, it sounds like one of the big value propositions, if I'm understanding you right, that you guys bring is, I'm guessing, and I don't even know what the amount of time would be, but to your point about, you know, you would never set up 500 machines or 5,000 machines with a DVD, even using today's modern virtualization and copies of VMs, setting up a HPC cluster in and of itself is just a complicated task, right? And so,
yep, and
so
we,
you guys come in and make it so I kind of just define what I want, and then I don't have to worry about, well, crap, did I forget to set the registry key on this machine or you know, change that Unix, you know, file property setting. I don't have to worry about that stuff because I can just say this is kind of what I want, and you guys are handling that for me and basically reducing my complexity. So in the end, I get, for a lot less work, I get my larger scale much faster and easier.
Yes, everything works out of the box. So you don't have to go figure out problems that have already been solved by other people.
Right, okay. Yeah, so that's a huge time saver, even before you add in, you know, some of the additional machine learning and whatnot on it that I guess adds more intelligence to these clusters.
We don't use machine learning techniques for our own for managing the cluster. We just provide the whole toolbox for users to get their computations going to solve their problems using our libraries for machine learning.
Right.
It's actually
yeah.
not our libraries. It's, so we just package them and we compile everything. We make sure that the dependencies are solved, which can be a big task as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a good point, though. So in order to deploy, write an application, it has to be targeted for your kind of cluster, right? It has to be a specific set of libraries that applications have to be compiled in with to use it.
No, these are all open standards. So, for example, the majority of HPC software has been developed against a message passing library called MPI. So we ship various flavors of MPI, OpenMPI being a popular one, for example. And we make sure that all of those different MPI flavors are available for users who are looking to compile their application against them.
Got it. So as long as the apps are written against the MPI standard or specification, it should run in your environment.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great, if I may, about the solution that Brian proposes, because it's not just the HPC scheduling capabilities, as I was saying. They bundle up pretty much everything you could possibly want or want to do with a cluster. And now that they have added Azure to the mix in the same kind of toolkit kind of way, making it extremely easy and transparent, I think it opens this wonderful possibility of, let's say you don't have GPUs on premises and you want to start solving some problems with GPUs, you can tap into Azure for that. You can deploy a cluster with a X number of GPUs. We even have GPUs with these InfiniBand interconnects, so you can leverage MPI there and run that problem without having to, you know, source GPUs on premises.
Well, and it
that's
sounds
what
like
gets me really excited.
And it sounds like that also helps the customer solve the problem of, hey, I have this computation and that I need to get it done overnight, right? That's kind of one of the classic things. I need this to be ready for the morning, right?
That is the classic one.
Yeah, and you know, I have 500 machines in my data center. Well, darn, my data set has grown to the point that now it's not done till noon. By tying into the cloud piece, the customer can scale up to kind of drive their time back down to what they want. And Bray Computing helps them, it sounds like helps them do that, again, without really any additional complexity to the customer. It's just, hey, I drag some slider somewhere and say, I need, you know, 700 machines instead of 500 machines. Done.
That's exactly it. Yeah. Is the dreaded queue, right? Everybody hates the queue because as you're, if you have an on-premises cluster, you want to run it at 100% capacity, basically, to get the most out of your bucks. But that means you always have a little bit of a queue, so you kind of oversubscribe your queue.
Yeah.
And if the queue keeps growing, what you get is irate emails and calls, right, from your users.
Yeah.
So this allows you to say, okay, the queue's too big, or there's this high priority job, whatever it might be. And the other thing, by the way, that I hear often is we have this enormous problem, going back to what you were saying earlier, we have this enormous problem. We want to solve this new, research project, whatever it might be, and the 500 cores won't cut it. I mean, it would need to run on the whole cluster for a month. That means a queue that grows for a month. And with a solution like Bright, you go, okay, you know, let's just give it 1,000 cores and get it over with and get those results for whatever. It could be a research paper, it could be a business opportunity right away, literally overnight.
But you also get the benefit of now you're not stuck with 1,000 machines sitting in your data center. Right, because you had to buy them, and once you bought them, they pretty much don't let you return them after you have run this computing job.
So how, explain to me how does that work? That burst functionality, it sounds like it's transparent, but like, so is there some integration layer that Bright Computing has built with Azure that does all the hard work of deploying the necessary bits into Azure transparently in the back and getting it up and running?
Yeah, the key thing is uniformity here. So we provision nodes inside of Azure exactly with the same software image as we provision nodes on-premise. So that means that the software that you're moving to the cloud will actually not even notice that it's running in the cloud because the environment looks and feels exactly the same as what it's used to on-premise. So that means that scientists don't have to do any work to modify their applications to run inside of Azure, for example. And the way we do that is we boot nodes, we boot virtual machines inside of Azure using a very small image, which we call our node installer image. And on an on-premise cluster, this node installer image would actually get loaded over Pixie booting. So that's network booting, basically. So the provisioning process for instances inside of Azure is exactly the same as it is for on-premise nodes. So they get provisioned exactly the same way. They get managed the same way. They have the same software environment. So everything in the cloud is the same as it is on-premise, except the latency between your nodes is obviously between your on-premise and your off-premise nodes is a little bit larger.
Now, I was going to ask you, how do you solve the the interconnects, like with the if apps require that InfiniBand connection? Obviously, they're going to run differently between the on-premises and Azure.
Yeah, but very few jobs consume the entire cluster. So if you have a 1,000-node cluster, it's pretty rare that a single job would consume 1,000 nodes. So what is much more common is that you have jobs that require 64 nodes, some 128 nodes, for example. And what you obviously cannot do is run a job that spans nodes on-premise and off-premise. So actually, you could do that. So you could run an MPI job that spans all different regions of Azure and also on-premise nodes, but the latency is going to be terrible. So you're going to have really bad performance if you do that. So
Right, right, right.
nobody's really interested in doing that.
So you cut up your workload in such a way that, you're either running part of it completely in the cloud or part of it completely on premises.
Yeah, I mean, an HPC cluster typically has a large queue of jobs that need to be executed. So one job may run on-premise and another job may run off-premise, for example. But no job is going to span on and off-premise.
Got it. That makes sense. Great. This is really good. I really like now so Felipe, the HPC itself, right, and the batch, just from an Azure perspective, how is that? Like, we haven't heard much about that whole flow there. How's the adoption been in the Azure batch space, for example?
Pretty good, actually. What I like is that we have, with a combination of HPC pack, as I was telling you, that continues to grow, we have what I tend to call a catalog or a buffet of options for our customers. So what we've seen mostly is traditional customers with whom we have either worked because they had HPC pack, so we worked with them before, or that have solutions like Bright or other HPC schedulers running on premises, they tend to prefer the hybrid solution. So they tend to lean towards this bursting when my queue is long, or when I need something more resources for something special. Slowly, that progression, and some customers also tend to take the other approach, which is let's deploy as infrastructure as a service, because that way I have a cluster that looks and feels and runs the same HPC scheduler on premises, maybe the same distro of Linux, for example, as the one on premises, so I can use my scripts and my apps. So that's kind of the all cluster in the cloud scenario, the infrastructure as a service scenario. Batch takes it a step further, right? Batch gives you this ability to completely forget about the infrastructure and even the scheduling, because that's taken care of by a service, literally a cloud service, fully managed, that you talk to and say, hey, run this job with this number of tasks, and by the way, I want you to spin up a cluster automatically for me with 1,000 cores, and spin it down when you're done, and just store the results in permanent storage. So that's very attractive for developers, and particularly for ISVs. Early on, we had a few ISVs that were not comfortable with batch. They wanted to do the infrastructure as a service route because, again, they felt it was a more they felt more comfortable in an environment they were used to managing. But very quickly, they realized if you're offering SaaS, it's software as a service, it's much better to have a service layer underneath that takes care of all of that. So we have many ISVs adopting it. We actually use it internally quite a bit. We have, I don't know, the genomics teams have an amazing accelerator for their for GATK and BWA, for a genomics pipeline that is running on top of batch, because their focus is on that workload and accelerating that alignment and everything else that those tools do, and they don't want to worry about infrastructure. So we have quite a few solutions like that. So what I think the trend is going to be over time is solutions like Bright that provide those two worlds, the burst, or like Martijn was saying, that the full cluster in the cloud that behaves, feels, and looks exactly the same as on premises, is going to be the normal trend. And then eventually, it's a little bit like the PaaS story, the platform as a service versus infrastructure as a service. I think more and more people will start going towards the HPC as a service solution. And what my team is doing now, actually, is we're going a little bit further up. We're building a new stack on top of it, trying to have basically, what would you call it? Basically, a solution layer on top of it. Instead of thinking about I'm gonna, tap into batch to get resources and scheduling so that I can do rendering, we're looking into having a rendering service on top of it that understands how rendering works and everything else. That's where we're going.
So I gotta ask, but and I guess I'll pose it both to both you guys independently because you know you probably have different answers. What is the largest number of nodes that you've seen that you can disclose, right? Kind of in this forum, that with your you know with your softwares.
I've seen customers run 6,000 nodes in a single cluster, and one particular customer that I like to bring up is an oil and gas company in the Middle East who had about 3,500 nodes that they wanted to boot all the way from being powered off to being fully provisioned and operational in 15 minutes. So these were diskless nodes, which means the operating system had to be deployed from scratch every time the nodes boot.
Yeah.
So we were not able to do that, but we were able to do it in 20 minutes, which I think was already
that's pretty close.
Which I think is impressive. Yeah.
I ask just because like you guys are casually throwing out 500 nodes, 1,000 nodes, like that's still for most people that's a ridiculous number of servers at once.
Well, I'll tell you, the world is getting ready for exascale at the moment. So I think that's being planned for 2021 right now. So that means an exaflop of performance in a single system, and we're talking about 500,000 nodes in that case. So that's actually what we're preparing for. So right now, our scaling pretty much stops at about 10,000 nodes if you have a single head node. So we know what we have to do in order to scale beyond 10,000 nodes, and 500,000 nodes is our goal for 2021.
Wow. Felipe, how about you? What's the largest number of nodes in an Azure batch scenario that you can disclose publicly?
Now you want me to brag, don't you? So I don't remember the number of nodes. I'll give you the number of cores because we have to deploy in different sizes due to scalability and capacity. Yep. We did 100,000 cores across 14 regions with a partner of us, an ISV, called Towers Watson, now called Willis Towers Watson.
Wow.
They posed an interesting... Yeah, we had done 50,000 with them. And when they were kind of doing the HPC pack route, and they came to us and they fell in love with Batch and ported their software to Batch. I'm not joking, within a week, they were blown away. They were able to run within a week. And they immediately turned around and said, hey, let's do something big, but let's do something real. I said, okay, what do you guys want to do? 100,000 cores. I almost fell off my chair, but I went to talk to the capacity guys, and the capacity guys were incredibly nice and incredibly accommodating and told me, hey, we're actually deploying this bunch of capacity right now for, I don't remember, one of the big releases that we had. I think it was an Xbox release. And they said, I'll give you access to it. I could not believe my luck, of course. So I worked with a couple of people in my team, Alan Stephenson, among them, because he knows very well these huge scalability problems. And we managed to do, let me see, it was 100,000 cores, 14 regions. I think it took a while to deploy. It took like 12 hours to deploy. But what we did is we had them calculate the cost of insuring the whole population of the world with 100,000 dollars life insurance, the cost from the perspective of the insurer, because they run risk analysis for insurance companies.
Right.
So it was fantastic. We were actually surprised it worked so well.
That's amazing.
But the caveat is clear, right? Going to what Martin was saying, this is for embarrassingly parallel jobs that can actually be split not only across many computers that don't need to talk to each other, but they can actually be spread across the world. For those workloads that tend to be more common in HPC sometimes, you cannot do something like that. It would be, I mean, like Martin said, you can, but it's just going to take forever.
I just have this vision, right? So you know, Corey Sanders, right, who's, you know, well known as kind of the, you know, one of the really, you know, important figures in the IaaS, you know, VM world. I can just imagine Corey sitting down looking at his charts of, you know, number of cores consumed by day and, you know, VMs and going, hey, what's this spike? Oh, that's Martin's work. Oh, hey, that's Felipe's work. Oh, okay, yeah. You know, like, when you're talking that scale, you guys are going to show up in those kind of graphs. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, the capacity guys know us very intimately. Yeah, they're incredibly nice folks because sometimes, we and sometimes we don't know, to be honest. Sometimes we get an email from the capacity team saying, what are you guys doing? Are you running a test? I know. And we go look into it, and it's a customer we didn't know was running on an enormous scale. And when we come to the customer and say, oh yeah, we were doing some small scale tests. We got to the end of the quarter, so we're going to do our financials, and we needed the 10,000 cores, so we just went for it. Like, it's like, can you let us know next time?
That's amazing. Yeah, because, oh, wait a minute. You guys are the reason that everybody in CSS got an email like 6 months ago that said, immediately, right now, you need to delete all your VMs that you have out there as test VMs. We need the extra cores right now. Now I know who to blame.
One of you. Maybe. I'll blame Alan. Alan is the one in my team that's always doing these enormous scalability tests. You should talk to him sometime. We should have him in the program, actually, because he's done incredible things.
Great. All right. So this has been really, really exciting stuff that you guys talked about. And Felipe, thanks for bringing Bright Computing on and allowing Martin to explain his side of things as well. I think there's a good dynamic here between the two of them. As you said, you guys work together very well, both the products, and that's good to see something that works so nicely.
Yeah, to me, what is exciting is having a solution as solid and as well recognized as Bright Computing. Choosing Azure and building a solution on top of Azure, to be honest, because I talk to many customers and that's what they use on premises. And without it, you have to find an alternative. In fact, there was a customer that was ready to look at something. I said, wait. Talking to Bright, they're coming with this solution. It's going to look and feel exactly what you do on premises. So it's a fantastic proposition for our customers.
Yeah, it sounds like a great kind of on-ramp, right, as they kind of get their feet wet with the bursting and then they start looking at removing some of the complexity for themselves and then adding in some of the added value stuff. So no, it sounds great. Thank you, Martin, for coming on.
Great.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys, again. I appreciate you taking the time and effort to make this possible. I know it's kind of odd hours for you guys, but I appreciate that. And well, if you have any links that you want to share with our listeners, any references that you want to share, we can put them along with the show notes with this episode. So please feel free to send it to me and we'll take care of it. All right.
Will do. Oh. Thank you.
All right. Great.
Thanks
a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.